classification of documents and other intelligence is a useful government tool, though it's one that rarely works. Joining us at the Axon Johnson Institute's Intelligence and Security Seminar, which is being held in Sweden, is Calder Walton. Calder is Assistant Director of the Applied History Project and Intelligence Project at the Belfer Centre for Science and International Affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. So, Calder, let's look at the issue of declassification in intelligence. First of all, what is declassification?
Well, declassification is the term that's traditionally used when governments release, not leak, but deliberately release intelligence, that's to say secret intelligence collected from either technical sources or human sources. So this is the term of that's used to describe that release into the public domain of previously secret intelligence.
And what forms can that take?
Well, as many different forms as you like. This can be a spokesman speaking at the podium in the White House. It can be a written document produced by the government. It can be also the declassification of historical records.
Mm-hmm. From the archives.
In archives, those that I spend more time than I care to admit studying in the National Archives in the UK.
And you've got a couple of examples of what we might call a success, a governmental success, and this involves the United States government, and one that might be considered a failure. Yeah. So let's go through those. Give us a classic example of a successful declassification by government.
One example of a successful declassification occurred during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, October 1962, when JFK's White House declassified the hitherto secret intelligence that it had on Soviet offensive missiles stationed in Cuba. JFK had already gone on air to describe that the government knew about the Soviet missiles, but at this moment, before the UN, was when, in his own terms, JFK decided to stick it to the Soviet government and present them with the evidence they had. And they did so in real time.
JFK, in a very public way,
at the UN General Assembly, with the U.S. Ambassador Adlai Stevenson presenting his Soviet opposite number with blown up photographs from U-2 spy planes of Soviet missiles on Cuba. This was a staggering success for the Kennedy White House. It was built on the fact that the fact that it was derived from U-2 spy planes. That was a secret that had already been blown. The Kremlin already knew that, thanks to the shoot down of the U-2 spy plane piloted by Francis Gary Powers. So that secret is already blown. So they weren't jeopardizing sources and methods, although they were still understandably very nervous about doing so. Mm. It was successful in that it allowed the Kennedy White House a significant propaganda or information victory against the Soviets, boxing the Soviet government into a corner. And it was from that the world opinion was on the side of the US government, and the Soviets were shown to be misleading the public about the nature of the missiles during the crisis.
Duplicitous.
Yeah.
And the staging of that, it was not only that those photographs were declassified, that intelligence was declassified, but it was declassified in the most dramatic way as well, wasn't it? It was a real propaganda coup by the White House.
That's right. As with so much about the Kennedy White House, it was extremely slick. It was a presentation which won over hearts and minds. And this was it seems to me, all the ingredients of an intelligence success, don't hear that phrase used too much, came together. It was reliably collected information. It was disseminated to decision makers, the White House, and decision makers, the White House, then used that intelligence, and in their decision was to release it. It's important to stress to your listeners that the decision to release intelligence almost always is by the executive branch, by decision makers, be it Downing Street or the White House. Usually the intelligence community's safeguarding their sources and methods are very much more hesitant about doing so.
It's in their nature, essentially.
Secret services do have a tendency to like to operate in secret.
Yeah. Do we get any sense now, 60 years on, who was the architect of that?
It was Kennedy himself. Right, so it was a pre-decided, this is, I'm getting this from the National Security Files at the JFK Presidential Library in Boston. But reading them, there was a deliberate plan to bring this intelligence to the UN. And the code word that JFK would authorize the release of it was stick it to him. And sure enough, JFK got on the telephone and called the team at the UN, the US delegation, and Adlai Stevenson got word, stick it to him, which meant, okay, go for it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what the world then saw.
And he was quite a mild-mannered.
It's absolutely striking that this is a sort of very avuncular, mild-mannered, almost academic type person. Mm. And when Kennedy saw this unfolding on TV, live in the White House, he turned to his aide and said, I never knew Adlai had it in him.
And so all the more dramatic for playing out of character, I suppose. And what was the immediate response of the Soviets?
Well, the Soviet government were boxed in and they had to keep trying to deny that these were... Then it shifted from we don't have any missiles there to these missiles are only defensive, not offensive, as you are saying. The Soviet government did what it did and what the Russian government does best, which is then to instigate a broad array of disinformation and misinformation about them, saying that the photographs were, quote, fabricated evidence by the U.S. intelligence service, the CIA. Mm. So query whether it had any impact whatsoever on public opinion behind the Iron Curtain, query whether people even knew. But that wasn't the audience that the White House had in mind. It was the free Western world that they had in mind.
And how important was it to bringing to an end the Cuban Missile Crisis?
I think it's fair to say it was one factor. Mm. It was certainly one factor. The decision, as we now know through the scholarship of others, was taken by Khrushchev that weekend on Black Saturday, so-called, when it became just too dangerous to carry on with this, and Khrushchev had decided to back down in the face of taking the world to the brink of war. There's a whole nother story, I fear we don't have time to get into that here, about how back-channel communications may have helped to get out of the situation, but also some back-channel communications. This is where the Kennedy White House looks rather less good and effective. In particular, Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, JFK's brother, his back-channel communication seems to have made the crisis more complicated and therefore dangerous. But that is a story that I think we'll have to discuss on another time.
Yeah. And you say that such successes are very rare. Yeah. Intelligence derived from declassification. Can you think of any others?
So I think that the war in Ukraine, the prelude to Putin's invasion of Ukraine, that was a striking U.S. and British intelligence success. And again, just to say it, this isn't a phrase that you hear that often. Mm-hmm. But in this instance, before Putin's invasion in February 2022, the U.S. and British intelligence communities had successfully uncovered Putin's plans for war. And both governments then decided collaboratively to declassify that parts of that assessment to make it known. First privately, as we now, I mean, the records aren't available, but when they are, just looking at the public reporting of this was when the fact that the director of the CIA was traveling to Europe frequently, where he met with heads of state, and public reporting says that the head of the U.S. intelligence community, the DNI, Avril Haines, she traveled to Europe in order to disclose the intelligence that they had on Putin's war intentions to often skeptical European leaders, mm-hmm. including, I think it's fair to say, Zelensky himself.
Really?
But that's he seemed to have been a lot more skeptical about this than the UK and and the US governments. Mm. So this was a striking example of getting it right. And it also laid the groundwork disclosing this intelligence for public opinion, particularly in the United States, that is very polarized at the moment and very fickle when it comes to foreign interventions.
And has an isolationist tradition.
And has a massively isolationist tradition that the Republican Party is clinging onto right now. And that actually this disclosure of intelligence, I think, laid the groundwork for U.S.-American public support for supporting Ukrainians' efforts to against Putin, against Russia.
And do you get any sense of who was the principal instigator of that? When you say it's a US-UK collaboration, do you get a sense of a narrative of how this came about?
Well, I will say that I'll be the first in line in 30 years' time when the records come out, if I'm still around then, to have a look exactly who was going on. But public reporting suggests that this was the White House. I think it's also fortuitous that at this exact moment, the director of the CIA is Bill Burns, William Burns, a veteran U.S. diplomat and former U.S. ambassador in Russia. It's not difficult to imagine that he had clearly been the consumer of intelligence for years and decades. He knew how to use it. It was, I think, fortuitous that he was on the other side, as it were, the director of the CIA at this moment and understood how this intelligence could be used. Will we see that playing out in the records when they one day become available? I think more likely than not, yes.
Has there been a change in the last 20 years in terms of public trust in intelligence agencies? I mean, famously, the Iraq War was a major propaganda problem for British and American intelligence agencies. Have there been efforts to restore that?
I think a problem is putting it politely. I think that it was the damage that the Iraq War has done to the public perceptions of British and US intelligence, both in their own domestic audiences, but then internationally, cannot be overstated. That this miscalculation of the intelligence, this erroneous intelligence, hugely damaged the public policy perceptions of the U.S. and British intelligence communities. This is, I think, the successful release of intelligence before Ukraine is helping to correct that public perception. And also, I think that the reasonable person now, if there is such a person still around, will understand that intelligence is not right all the time. If there were simple answers, it wouldn't involve intelligence agencies. And sometimes there are miscalculations, as with Iraq, that had disastrous consequences. So I think that this is a small step to rebuilding some of the public policy faith in government institutions. Whether that can be done in this day and age, I think that we all are watching it play out. I think that my own view is that the big tech companies have a vital role to play in this by helping to provide consumers of information with a measurement of whether that information that they are seeing is reliable, verifiable, or whether it is perhaps been fabricated in some instances by hostile state governments.
And some have taken a small step towards that.
That's right. It's work in progress. Yeah. I think that, as with so much, let's watch this space in terms of the 2024 U.S. presidential election. I'm particularly alert to the use of deepfake videos purporting to be from one party or another circulating on social media. This has been much discussed in recent years, but as of yet, no hostile foreign government has really made use of them in a way that those of us looking at this space predicted. But I think that 2024 might be the moment when they are used by Russia or by China.
And AI only makes it worse.
That's the thing, AI-driven deepfake videos. I mean, it's, I'm afraid, a really horrendous state of affairs out there on the social media landscape.
And so there's no suggestion that successes will become more common. In fact, quite the opposite.
That's exactly it. I think that even when governments do their best efforts to declassify reliable and accurate intelligence and decision makers use it and they put the message out, there is still going to be a significant segment of public audiences in the West that simply don't believe it. And that's why I think that the effort that we're talking about here is to help correct Truth Decay. That's the title of a RAND Corporation study that is very valuable in this space. I think that there has to be a public and private partnership to do so.
Yeah.
So fusing government bodies, agencies, departments, collaborating with the big tech companies to correct misinformation and disinformation, particularly on social media.
And this will be a particular responsibility for a US government, of course, simply because that's where so many of the tech companies are based.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Do you think these new technologies increase the aura of secrecy or remove some of its magic?
No, really good question. I mean, I think the aura, I mean, I'll point in the direction of a recent speech by the chief of MI6, Richard Moore, where, I mean, the fact that the chief of MI6 is currently on Twitter or X himself reveals how far this has come in such a short time. And in his public speech, recent public speech, he is quite clear that where he says that the age of the Secret Service is over. The analog Secret Service is over, and now intelligence agencies have to operate in an open source environment where everybody has too much information than they know what to do with at the flick of a finger. So his own service, you know, the Secret Intelligence Service, is grappling with exactly this, and even they, dare I say it, have come in from the cold. That's a striking example of how far things have changed. Does that mean that the aura of a Secret Service is removed? Possibly. Is that something that they need to live with? I think definitely yes.
So let's go back to that simpler age of analog, Calder. And we've talked about a striking success, two striking successes, actually. There's a myriad of failures. Give us an example of a classic failure of declassification.
Well, the failure that I think of is the Reagan White House's use of intelligence in 1983, on the 1st of September 1983, regarding the shoot down of a Korean airliner, KAL-007, that was flying from the U.S. from Anchorage to Seoul. The plane strayed badly off course, and a Soviet fighter shot down the commercial 747 plane, killing everyone on board. NSA, the eavesdroppers, were able to obtain, stationed in Japan, were able to obtain recordings of the fighter pilot talking about locking on and destroying the target.
Yeah.
When this information was shared with the White House immediately decided to go on the offense and declassify in real time that information. Secretary of State George Shultz appeared at the podium and shared transcripts of that intelligence to the world. First time that's ever happened. Mm-hmm. Unambiguously came from U.S. signals intelligence collection capabilities. Yeah. It turned out, and the reason why this is such an awful situation, apart from the horrendous facts, was that actually the intelligence was still being analyzed, and the Reagan White House had got ahead of themselves.
Yeah.
And they declassified just the first draft with other material still being translated from the Russian. When that other material was made available, it became clear that the Soviet air fighter pilot did not know that this was, as the White House suggested, mm-hmm. he in fact did not know that it was a commercial aircraft, and that it was, he did not know that this was simply a plane that had strayed off course.
Yeah.
So a very different result. Mm-hmm. And but unfortunately, Reagan went one step further, and then 5 days later made an alarming TV appearance in which he called the Soviet government had instigated an act of barbarity, a crime against humanity. NSA was furious about this, that their intelligence had been misconstrued and politicized, and also had jeopardized their underlying sources and methods.
Yeah, and this is a classic example of what's called rhetoric outrunning the facts.
That's exactly it. That's what Bob Gates, in his memoir, very diplomatic as always, director of CIA, said that the White House's rhetoric had got ahead of the facts. So there's a striking example of all the ingredients coming together in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is how what's important to know is that this is how badly things can go wrong. But I'd like to come back to my original point, which is the fact that we're living in an age where so much more information is available allows governments, it seems to me, to outsource that those capabilities to look at commercial providers of intelligence and say, actually, this information is available from X, Y, and Z, or is on publicly available social media. We don't need to jeopardize any sources and methods that we have because it's already out there. So I think that that's what was happening with the run-up to the war in Ukraine, and I think we're going to see more of that as we go forward.
That's fascinating, Calder. Thank you very much for that. And, of course, if people want to know more about this subject, where should they go?
Well, they might, if they choose, go and have a look at a copy of my book, Spies, The Epic Intelligence War Between East and West, that was published over the summer this year.
Brilliant. Thank you, Calder. Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.